campaign is sort of the conservative movement's utility infielder. He's done just about everything. He sent off a resume which does tell more than really anybody ought to know about him. But briefly, he's a graduate of Williams, where he succeeded in getting rid of William Sloan Coffin, and Mr. Coffin then took up residence in New Haven, and we've all been eternally grateful to Jim for that. He was managing editor of the Henry Regnery Company's trade division. He has been editor of the Daily Calumet until recently, and he is currently doing freelance work. He's a director of practically everything, the Charles Edison Memorial Youth Fund, the Americans for Effective Law Enforcement, which is a poor man's ACLU, director of YAF, he's a member of the Nakian Society and the National Rifle Association, and a contributor to or on the board of every conservative periodical there is, Jim Campaign.
I told Ross earlier this was going to be the first and last time I ever got moderated by him. Flying in yesterday from South Africa, I was kind of grasping around trying to figure out how to carry on the immortal tradition of Jim Wiggins, starting off with a funny story. Fortunately, the pilot, as we flew over Cape Cod, made a rather nasty reference to the island of Chappaquiddick, which reminded me of a conversation I had with a fellow in South Africa who recently squired James Jackson Kilpatrick around down there. South Africans, understandably, are very concerned that Ted Kennedy may become a presidential candidate and possibly be elected next year. And therefore, Kilpatrick was constantly pestered by South Africans, wondering whether he would be able to shake off the albatross of Chappaquiddick. Kilpo said he really didn't know, but that he had the albatross, and he had it in his top drawer, and he took it out once a week and oiled its wings. Sure, the South Africans not to worry that bird was going to fly. I think in talking about the media, the printed word particularly, and especially in light of the recent fixing of the conservative guns on the media with Agnew and now with a lot of the conservative organizations, especially ACU with their new media watch, it's a good idea to define the problem of the media, which I think is not a media problem at all. And I think it's dangerous for conservatives to, at least serious conservatives like those of you in this room, to start firing away at the media per se, because I think it's a manifestation of the problem and not the problem itself. And of course, the problem is what Stan Evans called America's only social problem, the liberal problem. The liberals have a very definite way of looking at the world. It's an astigmatic way of looking at the world. This plan does not link up with reality at all. But at the same, and the functionaries of liberalism in the media, in the academy, wherever these people are, Hayek calls them the intellectuals, the second-hand dealers in ideas, are in a very real sense, I think, innocent of insincere behavior. They really don't know what they're doing. You read a lot of these people talking about Agnew now. Because they see the world in the way they see the world, they don't realize that they are, in fact, giving us a distorted picture of the world in the media. And for conservatives to begin firing their guns at these people is not going to cause the sort of dialogue that we ought to have, because the argument will be cast in the wrong terms. the liberals will not understand what we're talking about and think we're a bunch of nasty scolds who just want to replace their way of looking at the world with what they view as another warped way of looking at the world. At the same time, I would encourage ACU and YAF and the rest to continue the effort because I think it's excellent for fundraising, and it's also an excellent way to train people and make people aware of the problem. But for serious conservatives, I think we have to understand that the problem is liberalism and not a group of nasty people in the media who are self-consciously trying to deceive the rest of us. I'm not really competent to talk about the liberal problem. I'd like to make a couple of observations anyway. It seems to me the problem, as it's manifested in the media or in the academy or wherever ideas are talked about, has been pretty well explained by Eric Vogelin in his papers on Gnosticism. Herman Kahn has, I think, done interesting work in talking about the battle in this country between secular humanism and the traditional American culture. Stephen Tonser, you've heard him lecture and read his many papers on this subject. And I think it's clear that liberalism is an ersatz religion, and therefore a difficult thing to deal with in terms of intellectual combat. It's very difficult to argue a man out of his religion, especially when he's had it pumped into him all the way from Sunday school through college. It's a utopian, messianic, and intolerant religion, or ersatz religion. And whereas previously in this country, before this thing sort of hit us in the 20th century, debate over political and economic questions in the media or wherever else operated sort of under the umbrella of the traditional Western civilization, a Christian West. And beneath that, we had a pluralistic discussion of the issues that wasn't confused by a religious worldview because everybody shared the same religious worldview. It was easier to have a decent and humane argument back and forth without getting into the sort of nastiness you get into when you're arguing over religious, essentially religious or philosophical, deeply felt views. And so I think the problem of liberalism in the media is that we are now experiencing a lockstep liberalism, utopianism in our culture. And the functionaries of this vision of the world, flawed as it is, are innocent. Of course, the answer to this problem is scholarship, pure and simple. Get right back to the source of where all these ideas come from. The long-term answer is, anyway. Milton Friedman has proved that in economics. It just plain has to be done in other areas. As far as the church goes, the best we can all do is on that question is just to pray. There is, I think, one other faint hope for conservatives, that there is a possibility always in human affairs, as we see from reading history, that we do get fortuitous political accidents of one kind or another. I think as far as the United States goes, the ascendancy of the socialists and the New Deal coming as a result of the Depression, which, as Friedman's monetary history has shown, was just caused by a colossal error and by the Federal Reserve System. These people, in effect, carried out an intellectual coup d'etat in the country in the 30s, and using the high forum of Washington, D.C., quickly employed their rhetoric and spread their intellectual hegemony countrywide, and from that followed up a mopping up operation and in the academy and then everywhere else. So I think as far as the ultimate problem, the liberal problem goes, we've got to concentrate on our scholarship and polish the arguments, get the books published, get them spread around, train the young people, continue doing what we have been doing the last 10 or 20 years, and wait for our opportunity, provided it comes. Talking about newspapers per se, magazines also, the press in this country, I think aptly called the fourth branch of government, the fourth estate, there are special problems in the press that I'd like to run through just a couple of them. One is concentration of ownership. And this has led to a lot of diminution of quality in a lot of newspapers. We know what concentration also is done in television by having the two or the three networks all here in New York City and all everything that goes through them put out by people that think the way people in Manhattan think as opposed to the rest of the country. But until the 50s, we had in this country newspapers that were operated by families, whether the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or the Pulliam newspapers or whatever, operated as a public trust. And publishing the newspaper was, first of all, a civic duty for the betterment of the community, and secondarily, a business. Newspapers are very profitable businesses anyway. And as a result, it's possible to have the best of both worlds, at least a marginally profitable business, and also an endeavor that was for civic betterment and education and all of those things that newspapers are so very good at doing. But as a result of capitalism or the same problem Henry talked about in book publishing, newspapers began to be combined, the Gannett chain, the Newhouse chain, the Hearst chain still operates more as a public trust, at least it certainly doesn't operate very profitably. And the Gannett is a good example of well-run newspapers on the business side, but with mediocre editorial product. And all of Gannett's, or most of Gannett's newspapers are monopoly newspapers. And as a result, especially, again, with the Chicago Tribune, which is now managed by businessmen rather than a giant like Colonel McCormick, business comes first. And when business comes first, how a businessman reacts with Mayor Daley or President Johnson or whatever. They don't muddy the waters. They try to avoid controversy. They don't know what they believe in anyway, so the newspaper tends to adopt a let's just get along with the powers that be attitude. And as a result, we are losing a very, very vital independent voice in this country, a voice that for a couple of hundred years since the founding of this country has served as that vital check on government that, that no other institution in this country had. The Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times are family-owned and are run, I think, as a public trust more so than as a business, although, again, they're very profitable. But of course, we know how the people that own those papers view their public trust. They're excellent newspapers, especially in local affairs. But we are seeing a great dwindling of these newspapers that are operated as a public trust, and it's something that concerns me very much, and I really don't know what we're going to do about it. Theodore White had a very interesting article in the Columbia Journalism Review in the winter of 69 that you might have a look at discussing that problem. Another problem that unions face, the newspapers face, are the labor unions. It's not quite as serious a problem on the editorial side as it is on the mechanical side, but it does put pressure on profits, because the wages are so exorbitant, the unions are so powerful, and as a result does bleed money away that could be spent on, again, civic betterment or the high purposes for which newspapers should be published. And also, the unions, when they unionize a editorial side of the newspaper, do tend to, I think, cause a change in the mind of many of the people that are the writers for the paper. Whereas, I think earlier, a newspaper man was in a profession. But the trade mentality that comes along with the union is not a healthy thing. Patrick Moynihan wrote a thing on the press not too long ago, perhaps many of you saw, which ties in, I think, nicely with the problem of the journalism schools as well. Moynihan pointed out that the people that are being hired by newspapers as working pressmen tend to be elite types. They tend to be people that live in the suburbs. They tend to be people that are remotely or even more so intellectual, as opposed to the people that used to work on the newspapers, who are much closer to the common people than the average suburbanite is. They knew the language. They knew what communities were in a city, for example, but the kind of feeling of community that you don't have in a suburb that you do have in, an ethnic neighborhood in a large city, hundreds of ethnic neighborhoods. And this has also caused a further gap between the reader and the newspaper itself, a problem of communication. It makes the role of the newspaper in leading people to in good and just causes in communities much more difficult, because the people that are doing the leading aren't talking the language, using the rhetoric that creates coherent images in the minds of a Serbian or Polish factory worker in the south side of Chicago. Again, I have no great answer to that problem. Henry mentioned the Medill School of Journalism, and there's an interesting anecdote which I can't trace the source of. But the dean up there, I was told some years ago, was a Stakhanovite liberal who made a very definite point of sort of finding out the political leanings of his students. And as a result, never made a point of never recommending a conservative student to be hired by the Chicago Tribune. He fed only liberals to the Tribune. And the Tribune is today, in case you don't know it, running headlong into the liberal camp. It is no longer a conservative newspaper. It has become the New York Herald Tribune in style and design. And I suspect in another 3 or 4 or 5 years, what was once also in the business sense, a very successful operation, is going to be on the rocks because of its liberalism and because of its approach to putting out a newspaper. Another thing that newspapers don't do, which I find hard to understand, is they do not assign intelligent people to cover education. We spend more money on education, we waste more money on education in this country than on anything else, billions and billions and billions of dollars. And the education writer for most newspapers is maybe one-tenth of a cut above the religion writer. It's an interesting set of priorities, isn't it? The religion editor of the Chicago Daily News in Chicago is the anti-religion editor. The religion page of the Chicago Daily News has nothing but news of Unitarians and fallen priests and this sort of thing. It's a very strange thing, I think. Again, a result maybe of the liberal vision, but in the public school systems in this country, we've been saddled with, since the last part of the last century, with an approach as opposed to the European gymnasium approach of education, with this free public education of extremely mediocre content. And you don't hear voices anywhere in the country asking for real education, for intelligent spending of the money. Again, a very strange thing. One final point, I think conservative publishers, those few that are left, although there are more than most people realize, most of them located in medium-sized cities like Indianapolis or Richmond, Virginia, or Columbus, Ohio, or Nashville, Tennessee, or the Copley papers in San Diego. They are doing themselves long-term damage by not making sure they go through a very fundamental re-education of their working press, re-education or re-indoctrination or whatever you want to call it. But having done this to a certain extent with a small daily newspaper, wandering out into the city room, engaging the people in, that wrote the news every day, and political discussions, and finding out where they didn't know what they were talking about, challenging them a little bit, giving them a book to read or an article to read. Very small thing, and I think it's extremely bad management for especially a conservative publisher that takes his beliefs seriously, not to have a guy either do it himself or have someone responsible for internal indoctrination. Very simple, very inexpensive sort of thing. It could be either overt or covert, but I think conservative publishers ought to make a point of doing it. Despite what Willie Schlamm said at lunch today, I'd also like to close on a hopeful note. Having been very, very active in the young conservative activity, which is essentially a training activity since 1960 or so, the legions are coming. They're bright. They've been through political campaigns. They've been through academic battles. They're now securing posts in universities, PhDs as teaching assistants. They're achieving tenure. Harvard University, which has been maligned a good bit here and has been at every conservative meeting ever held, has some fine, fine young conservative professors being taken aboard. I don't know whether they'll receive tenure or not. But I do think, especially in the first class Ivy League universities, those liberals who are of the Clinton Rossiter sort, who are not fanatic about their, I mean, who are in fact scholars, and to whom politics is secondary, are beginning to ease off the sort of persecution we saw in the 50s, Wilmore Kendall at Yale, or Glenn Saxon at Yale, or any professor anywhere else, where men were either denied tenure or never given pay raises. This sort of thing seems to be, at least at the front line universities, like Harvard or Yale, less of a problem than it used to be. And I think the reason it's not a problem is whereas your young liberal PhD that comes along has learned everything by rote, or learned much of what he knows by rote, and has soaked up this liberal vision of the world. The conservative young scholar that comes along has had to fight for every single idea he's had. And it's made him a much better man, it's made him a much better scholar. And I think in this little simple observation, lies a great deal of hope for our common enterprise. Thank you.